showing 3:30. Are you Ted?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and get started if we have everyone here. Joel Ashbrenner, who is our chair, I know is not going to be able to be here due to a family emergency, and our thoughts and prayers are with him and his family in Michigan. With that in mind, we'll move right into the first item on the agenda, the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden Agreement.
Yeah, Sue, I think the group is probably well aware, but just by way of a little bit of history here, Des Moines Waterworks had operated the Des Moines Botanical Center for about 8 years, from 2004 to 2012, based on an agreement that we made with the city of Des Moines. And then near the end of our tenure there, a group of local business leaders came forward and said that they would be willing to take over operation of the Botanical Center, provided there was some a period of ongoing support from the city and from Des Moines Waterworks. Our board actually in June of 2012 entered an agreement with that group, and in January of 2013, that group took over operation of the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden. So January 1st, 2013 was the day the keys were handed over. Our commitment of support is scheduled to end at the end of 2022. So we're about a year and a half out from the end of that original 10-year commitment, but in the interest of ensuring a smooth transition and in the interest of trying to shore up the educational offerings of the Botanical Garden relative to water quality and water in general, we thought it best to work out a kind of a transitional plan there that would include a reduction in support over time from Des Moines Waterworks to the Botanical Garden, include a short extension of the agreement, and include some fairly meaningful increase in the educational offerings related to water. So staff, and when I say staff, I mean primarily Jennifer Terry, has worked with the Botanical Garden on what that educational offering would look like. The Botanical Garden actually put that into a proposal that we have received, and it is attached to the memo, and we can go through that in as much or as little detail as you would like. But the financial terms are shown there at the bottom of the memo, where we're proposing that in 2022, the last year of our current support agreement, the financial support would remain the same. We have coordinated with the Botanical Garden folks to create an understanding that we're not going to provide any more in-kind support after the end of 2021. We're going to ask that they retain the expertise that they need for maintenance and repair of their facilities through other contractors or possibly employees, and they have agreed to do that. Then there's going to be a short extension there for 23, 24, and 25 in terms of financial support. You can see the declining level of that support. And on the flip side, the free water is going to decline, or another way of looking at that is that the Botanical Garden is going to begin to pay for a percentage of their water use. In 2022, again, the last year of our current agreement, they would continue to receive free water, but then their payment for water would increase by 20% each year for 4 years until actually in 2027, they would pay for 100%. We have discussed with them, Sue, the question of water for the Trellis restaurant. They're certainly aware of that now, and they're aware that they have some options there. Trellis having a separate service line that comes all the way in from our main and separately metered is probably not an option because of the very unusual way that the Botanical Garden is served with water from a dead end street far to the east that would be an enormous undertaking, but they have other options. They may be able to meter them separately so they know how much water they use. They could certainly include some amount of water in the lease arrangement that they have with Trellis. And we've discussed all of that with them. They haven't decided what they're going to do, but they're certainly aware and are taking that under consideration. So this is an arrangement that staff felt would be workable and would put us on a path to separate ourselves from the botanical garden here in a fairly short period of time. Graham, as the board representative on the botanical garden board, is aware of these discussions, and he has seen this proposal. I thought he was going to be here today, but it looks like he's not able to make it. But he's seen this and was certainly supportive of bringing it to committee today for discussion. So I think I'll stop there, Sue, and see if I see Diane has joined us. See if you or Diane or anyone else have any questions or comments.
I was a couple minutes late, but I do have the question. I know that that's the financial agreement, but can you talk a little bit about the educational piece of it? Because I feel like that was supposed to have been a part of the agreement from day one, and it hasn't been.
Yeah, Diane, you're absolutely right. And I will say this, that in the original agreement, it was somewhat vague, but Jen has done a nice job of putting a lot more meat on those bones, and I'm going to actually let her talk to us a little bit and give us some highlights of what we've discussed with the Botanical Garden and what they have included in their proposal. Jennifer?
Sure. I am satisfied and actually I'm pleased with the amount of education about water quality that we have written into the proposal, and also that it's tailored to our particular messaging. So we ramp up from year to year. So we're starting out with adding, for example, we're going to be talking about our Think Downstream campaign and effort. And so that's going to be woven in with a lot of the things that they're doing. So one of the things they're doing is they're weaving us into their existing programming. For example, their garden water month, they're going to have specific messaging about the raccoon in the Des Moines rivers. It's very specific, and their effects on our ability to provide safe water, that's written into the proposal. Music in the garden is going to include a Think Downstream presentation by one of our staff members about treatment and clean water advocacy. So not only are we educating their audiences, which are different audiences than we often reach, we're educating them about watersheds, and we're also teaching them how to advocate for cleaner water. So in addition to weaving us into their programming, they've agreed to add additional nuances. For example, they have they're adding a new summer camp with a water theme. And so they're going to make it a water education, which will also include our staff presenting about the raccoon and Des Moines watersheds. They're going to put up bike trail signage, which is 500,000 plus trail users per year, of course, pending city approval. So we'll be reaching some new audiences along the bike trail. You're probably aware they're coming up with a master plan for their new garden exhibits, and that's going to include conservation practices that are proven to have positive water quality benefits to downstream users. So it's taken a lot to get here, and it's been some back and forth with them and with their staff, but they were willing to think creatively, and I'm satisfied and pleased with what we've come up with. So that's my take on it.
Ted or Jen, I have a question on this. As I was just trying to do the math and looking at our standalone financial contributions of $200,000 a year of in-kind plus the free water, if you look at only the $200,000, putting us where we are now and what you are talking about doing from 22 through 25, that would be an in-kind contribution of just under $1.4 million. And they have a number of recognition levels. I noticed there was reference to the Ruan Reflecting Garden or something. And I know we have the DuPont Room, and we have all of these various things. I wanted to get over there because as many times as I've been in there, I don't remember other than a sign being stuck in the yard saying, you know, Des Moines Water Works, would there be some ongoing, you know, recognition for someone, for a donor who had given $1.4 million plus the cost of water to be there permanently, long beyond the 2025 agreement? I can appreciate the, you know, our current thinking downstream, but that's not really sustainable. As you know, 20 years from now, if somebody walks through there and it's like, well, I wonder if Des Moines Water Works had anything to do with this.
It's a good question, Sue. I haven't had any conversations with them about ongoing recognition, and I don't know, Jen, that you have either.
Well, I'm just looking under the recognition tag or section, which you probably see. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything that's in sort of in perpetuity, but recognition on all season sponsors signage at the top level, recognition on signage and in their quarterly newsletter and those sorts of things. But as far as like a room or a plaque or something like that, no, we haven't really talked about that.
And I think when you first walk in the door, you know, there's a lot of recognition for some of those early donors. And I think we were one of them. And I always kind of wonder, why do we get just the little sign stuck in one garden that says water, when really, I remember when Fred Weitz and others came to us and they really said, without Des Moines Water Works, we cannot make this go.
You know, Sue, I wondered about that too. I'm a member and we've been going to these music events, and I have been looking specifically for where the Des Moines Water Works is acknowledged. There's a table off in a hall in the back that talks about Des Moines Water Works. And I'll say it's probably as much, I mean, we've had this agreement for a long time, and I don't know what we did to push these things with the Botanical Center, if anything. So I guess we probably bear some of the responsibility. Mm-hmm. For this, but I agree with you. All of these other groups and people are acknowledged, and I think I know what we've been doing, and we're nowhere in there except for that table in the back. I had one more question on the level of support. Is it a declining level of support, or is it just constant until that last year? Because I think that sometimes causes an issue, because you have a cliff as opposed to, you know, if we had the whole thing to do over again and the agreement in the 10 years, I think it should have been declining out to zero so that they could, so that they didn't have that kind of financial cliff to get over. So that was a question I had. Are we just continuing at the same level and they'll have the same cliff and we may have the same pressure of, we just need a few more years at the end of this?
No,
I see on page one, it shows the declining, it shows the financial contribution each year. This is on the Jen Terry memo. And then the declining for water. But along that same line, Diane, on the other document, the one that's labeled draft.
Yeah.
On the last page where it talks provide reduced botanical garden water usage rates as follows. I think there's a different word besides reduction that should be used, because it says 2022, 100% reduction. That's not clear to me. And even when you say 80% reduction, I think we could clarify that. And Jen, your document did a better job in the language, I thought, of describing what that would be, but I don't think the two really sync up.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sue. You know, and to be clear, the financial support is $200,000 is proposed for 2022, which is the last year of that original 10-year agreement. And then the following year, it's $100,000, and then $50,000, and then
$25,000. Okay, so great.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We did think that the way that they had described it, Sue, and what you were reading there, 100% reduction, that means they're paying for zero. That's confusing. And so in the memo that I put together and put Jen's name on, which I forgot that I did that, Jen. Sorry.
Well, you didn't have to tell. I mean,
I know, but I'm open and
honest. I mean, usually it happens the other way around.
Yeah. No, sorry. But anyway, we reversed that, Sue, so you can see how much of the water they're going to pay for. 2022, the last year of the current agreement, is they're paying zero, and then 20, 40, 60, 80. So it inclines to avoid the same kind of cliff in the reverse direction. And they've seen this, and their new CEO and I visited with about it at some length yesterday. And they're comfortable with this, and they're committed to putting this in their budget. And so I don't think, at least from a garden perspective, we're going to run into the same issue, Diane, where
right. That's great. Yeah.
And it's even staggered a little bit. They don't actually pay for 100% of their water till 2027.
Yeah, and that's fine with me.
A couple of years after our final financial contribution. So it really eases them into this over time. But in exchange, we get some nice educational offerings that Jen has done a lot of hard work on working out with them.
Jen, I wish we would have had you working on the zoo 10 years ago, because I don't think we would have been in the position we were in. But again, I want to go to their draft, which I don't think is as clear as your memo or Ted's. And on the back page, this is what really made me think about the recognition piece. It says on-site signage is top supporter, but in the sentence above that, it says that that will only go through 2024. I have a feeling the DuPont room is always going to be the DuPont room, and that the Ruan reflecting garden is always going to be. So I think we deserve, again, the 1.4 million. And then somewhere in the documentation, before we take this to the board, I would like to know what the value average, don't tell Amy, she doesn't have to give me to the penny, the average value of that free water a year.
Yeah.
I just think we're really cutting ourselves short if we don't talk about what that value is.
Yeah, I don't want to promise you it's to the penny or even to the dollar, Sue, but I think that the free water that we've given them during this term is $100,000 or something in that ballpark. We'll get you the number though. But yes, I think that the actual financial contribution is significantly more than the free water, but the water is very meaningful. I'm sorry, Sue, I think you're muted now.
So on the second paragraph of the Jen Terry Ted Corrigan memo, if we said in free water for 10 years with an estimated value of $100,000, I want that recognized in, you know, for 20 years from now, not necessarily for now. Those would be, I think those were the only questions or suggestions that I had.
Sue, may I have a question, follow-up question, if you don't mind. Do you have ideas on how I totally get where you're going, like instead of a room or a gazing pond, do you have sort of in your mind, or that's a creative thing that we should think about, like how would you see us being recognized in that long-term way? Did you have something in mind? Or
Diane, you've probably been there more than I have, but when you first walk in, isn't there a glass sign to the right that recognizes the largest contributors at various levels?
I can't remember. There's that living wall on the right, yes. But I can't remember the donors, but I'm probably going to be there Thursday night, so I'll take a look at.
and most organizations have donor recognition opportunities, just like we know with our foundation. So whatever would be at the $1.5 million range of recognition, I wouldn't ask them to reinvent something, but maybe it's, you know, the Des Moines Water Works terrace that goes around the upper level, or, you know, whatever they have, I think we should be recognized as much as DuPont is for the length of time that they are.
Yep. We'll look at their program and we'll have some conversation with them about that.
Great ideas though, Jen, on the education component. Thank you.
Yeah, I was really glad.
You're welcome, that was fun.
When it came time for that.
So Ted, will we bring this forward to the members of the board with, and just kind of report the suggested things that Diane and I would like to see added?
Right, I think what we'll do, Sue, is we will have those discussions. We'll try to get their proposal updated. We actually, one of the attachments to the memo is a draft amendment to our 2080 agreement with the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden. And we will try to get that updated. I had some thought of bringing that amendment to the board in July, but there really isn't a hurry other than we've been working right on this and we just would like to get it done. But yeah, July or August, I would see us bringing it to the full board, Sue, for actual approval. And approval of the amendment, which would include the extension and the funding levels. And we'll try to include in there too what if any kind of recognition could be appropriate. We may have some offline discussions about that, just kind of one-on-one, see mm-hmm. if we come up with something that's appropriate. If they have something available, maybe they have an idea of what would be appropriate.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I don't know.
It's beautiful there. I mean, it's just lovely what they've done.
And they have big plans. I think that they have done great work, to be sure. They're also planning to expand. They're planning to take over operation and maintenance of the Asian garden. I think they're going to use a lot more water in the future. And so having them have a financial responsibility there, I think will be good for all of us. So mm-hmm.
good.
But they have been great partners in this endeavor. Their new CEO, Kim Perez, has been great to work with. And so I think it will continue to be a good partnership.
Terrific, thank you. Cool. Our next item is the legal services RFP and the decision matrix, which is attached.
So I'm gonna pretty quickly hand this off to Amy, but as you all know, we did issue an RFP. We got five responses. And then we thought after a finance and audit committee meeting recently that it would be well to develop a decision matrix before we opened and reviewed those RFPs and extend the schedule a little bit so that we could do good work here, but I'm going to let Amy kind of walk us through what she's got here and have a conversation about this matrix.
Thanks, Ted. Before I do that, I do have the value of the unbilled water to the botanical garden. Donna got that to me very quickly. And I'm not going to give it to the penny, but it's about $112,000 since the inception of the contract.
So, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so the legal services RFP has of course been something that we've discussed over the last couple of months, and the Finance and Audit Committee decided to really make sure that we were doing a very thorough job in reviewing the responses, partly in light of regionalization, to allow that to come to kind of an end. And then also though, recognizing really how important that this task is. It is an incredibly important role to the board. And so we have received five responses to the RFP. And am I able to share my screen, Michelle Watson or Rachel? Might be easier. All right, are you all seeing the matrix?
Yes.
Okay. So the five responses are Dickinson Law, which of course is our current counsel, Dorsey and Whitney, Fredrickson and Byron, Hopkins and Hubner, and Whitfield and Eddy. And those RFPs remain closed until we complete our meeting today and gain some consensus on this decision matrix. But a decision matrix is something that staff regularly does through the RFP process for a couple reasons. It really ensures that the process is as objective as possible. And it also really serves as good documentation in case questions are asked later by the public or by other respondents. We have documentation that we can provide that there was, you know, a process that was followed and ratings were objective. And so this decision matrix really follows a similar format to what we've prepared for others, but I'm here to tell you that I'm happy to change this in any way that the committee wishes to change it. So the four reviewers and the Finance and Audit Committee has suggested, I should say, that the four reviewers be Joel and Sue and Ted and me as the two staff members. And so each of the reviewers would complete one of these matrices after reading the RFPs. And the scores would be from 1 to 100. Sometimes we do 1 to 10, but I have found that 1 to 10 really compresses the scores very tightly, and it doesn't really allow you a lot of room to differentiate and distinguish between the respondents. And so what I'm suggesting is 1 to 100 here. Mathematically, it all works out the same. And then, so we would go through as reviewers and we would rate each of these six categories, which were listed in the RFP. So in the RFP, we said that we would evaluate based on qualifications and experience, capability and resources to handle the work, other areas of advantage, interviews, references, and fees. And then I have some considerations within each category for reviewers or readers, you know, that certainly not meant to be all inclusive, but might just trigger some thoughts on how to evaluate it and things to look at. And then I'm suggesting that each of these categories be weighted as such. But what I really want to talk about today and get the committee's feedback on are these the right categories and are these the right weights for those categories? So for qualifications and experience, I've proposed that we weight that 30%. Capability and resources to handle the work, 20%. So those first two by themselves are half of the weighting. Other areas of advantage, 10%, a little bit lower. We plan to interview the respondents. And so I think that that is an important piece, frankly. And so I've suggested 20%. And then reference and fees, I'm proposing 10% for both. And you can see that those are the same weightings across the board. So as reviewers would enter a rating here, then it the spreadsheet automatically calculates the value. And all of that work is done within the spreadsheet. And so the final score will auto-calculate. And there's a place for comments for each category and respondent, and also just overall comments. And then the thought process would be that the reviewers will take some time and review these on their own and come up with their own matrix and evaluate them. And then we would come together and share and compare and perhaps compile an aggregate of everyone's. We can, you know, certainly do whatever the committee wishes, what process the committee wishes to follow there. So I'm going to stop and ask if there are any comments or feedback or requests to adjust any of the criteria or the weights.
Amy, let's talk about the timeline again, because I think it's important that we, you know, we will not be completing this until the interviews are completed. So could you kind of walk us through, in case anyone is listening to this later, as far as our timeline and when this would actually be completed?
The responses will be open tomorrow morning, and I'll start there and say that I'll distribute those to the committee members. And also, I will reach out to all five respondents. The contact information is kind of locked in those responses. And so when those are open, then I'll have the contact name and I can advise them, each of the respondents, of this more extended timeframe, just as a courtesy. And so those matrices and the responses will be available yet within a couple days. The Finance and Audit Committee and the reviewers then will review and evaluate the responses in August through October, roughly. That includes interviews, calling references. And so that whole process will be done August through October. I see us being done by October. And then we'll bring it back, discuss the results of the evaluation, interviews, and references at the November Finance and Audit meeting, and then make a recommendation to the board in November or December if we needed to.
Remind me again, are we talking about a five-year term on this, or where were we on that?
Yes, that is the recommendation that, you know, the board consider, you know, certainly not locked into, but consider every 5 years whether an RFP should be issued.
Because, you know, one thing that I was thinking about, and this was in light of Rick's, you know, where he is in his career and in his, you know, what he wants to be doing and when he wants to retire and that thing, and thinking about that for other firms, you know, and I don't know how we evaluate that, but if we get somebody who is a very senior member of the firm, and I know that this expertise does sometimes tend to go to those firm members, where they are in their career, and are they thinking about leaving? And, you know, again, are those people gonna be put down as the assigned attorney and then be thinking about leaving in a couple of years? I mean, I think it's something that we really need to think about, because it does take a while to develop this expertise. And maybe that's just a contract matter to put, you know, will the assigned attorney be able to complete the five-year term? I don't know.
Right. I feel like that could be something that, you know, the stability of the staff assigned could be something that we could ask about, frankly, in the interview. You know, I think that is important.
Yeah.
I have a question more for Diane, as our attorney that's on the call here, and Jen, you are as well, but we have a weighting of 50% between qualifications and experience and capability and resources to handle the work. Are we going to know, some of these firms, I think, have specialties in certain areas. I don't know that I am going to be able to, for something as heavy as what's going to come out to be 50%, judge as to whether or not that particular firm has the experience of the assigned attorneys to do that kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question, especially when you have number five references. And that's only 10%. So is references really a separate weighted category like that? Or is it, I don't know. I also wondered why fees was only 10%.
And Diane, would we know on qualifications and experience? I mean, some of these firms do have Des Moines offices, but are not Des Moines based?
Well, I think a lot of these areas of law, for example, you know, the work that I did on utility issues, the bar that dealt with those issues is very small. and the same people show up over and over and over again. So I would hope that we would get some references, some clients who have worked with them and in these areas. You know, I do wonder, we have the, I think we're going to get an assigned attorney who is probably an expert on one or two of these things, and then other people in the firm with the rest of the pieces of this, like construction contracts or labor and employment expertise. So we have to, I guess we'll have to figure out which of those primary are we interested in having? Are we interested in having an assigned attorney who has labor and employment experience or somebody with municipal law experience? Wow, I don't think I answered your question at all. I just talked
But, you brought the point forward, I think, even more to say, with really 50% and definitely 30% of that. So if they check the box on any one of those things, does that meet it, or do they have to have expertise in all? Because that's the wide range of law right there, from litigation to labor and employment.
You know, and I think that that's the balance that we have to make between the various firms as we read their proposals. I'm not intimately familiar with each of these firms, but I think most of them are large enough that they're going to have individuals who specialize. They're going to identify, I would expect, you know, who's going to be their labor and employment person, and who's going to be their contracts person. And they're going to give us a resume for that person and what they have done. And we're going to be able to kind of weigh the total there. And there are other things, legislative considerations. You know, we run a lot of legislative questions past our legal counsel. And I think that it's going to be up to us to review and get a sense from the proposals and from the interviews, you know, how complete do we think their bench is and how experienced. It may be hard to differentiate between one and two.
Okay.
As you're weighing their qualifications and experience on the one hand with against capabilities and resources. Again, I think all of these firms are pretty good size, but that's something we'll want to consider. How many people are on the team? How many resources do they have? And do they touch all the bases? This is not unlike all of the professional services agreements we do for engineers and architects, where we look at the relevant experience of the individuals in the firm, and then we look at kind of their bandwidth. You know, are they big enough to bring these projects in on time and on budget? I see those as two different categories. Whether we want to weight them differently is another discussion that I think we can have.
One comment I would make, just based on, you know, the discussion that we've had thus far and the questions, all good points. You know, one thing we could do is consider references as part of really qualifications and experience and capability and resources to handle the work. You know, we could ask a reference, do the attorneys respond timely? I think that that's really important. You know, that their timely responses, and as Ted said, that they have that bandwidth and what has been their experience. So we could collapse references into and just consider that, I guess, in the first two, and then add that 10% to the fees and have fees be 20%.
I like that better, because I think, how else are you going to be judged whether they work in a timely and capable manner, from the interview, with them saying, yes, we're timely and capable,
right,
or from the references?
Yeah, I do like that approach.
So I have another question, and it's on number three, other areas of advantage. When we have one recipient who is a our current vendor for the I see that definitely as something that would weigh under number three. Is that an unfair advantage to an existing one? Because I'm trying to think of outside of something that could be stated in the interview that would allow someone else to score that 10%. I just want it to be a fair playing field.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with Amy saying that not one through 10, but one through 100 for scoring, that there may be things. There may be a firm that has a number of maybe municipal utility boards, water boards that they advise. So maybe they okay. have several, and that would, you'd think, well, they get to see different aspects and different ways things are done. So I could see there could be other things. And again, you have such a range that that I could see others could put forward things that they think may make them desirable.
Okay. I appreciate that. I just don't want it to be unfair to anyone.
I think there are a number of things, Sue, that I personally would put into that category. If we could find someone who had an outstanding environmental law professional on their staff, I think that would be of great benefit to us. Mm-hmm. We use different bond counsel because there is one bond counsel in the Des Moines area who everyone uses, and they're not on the list, but that's another example of a type of expertise that if they had in-house could be very beneficial. And so I think there are other things. We don't know if these five are going to have that, but they may. And I think it's good to have the opportunity to note that separately from the other categories.
Yeah, they may have somebody who appears before the utilities board and is very versed on cost of service and rate design.
So just to clarify, is our recommendation then to add the 10% to number one, the 30%, and make it 40, or to add it to number two, which is 20%, and make it 30?
Or add it to fees and make it 20.
Yeah, that's
right. I'm sorry,
I'm talking about references, because we were talking about moving references
right.
Where will we state that?
It won't be, the weighting won't be separate. It will be a way to verify their capability and validate and do that scoring. But I think what we're looking at is adding that 10% to fees, because fees is pretty little right now. And maybe we should probably pay a little more attention to that.
You stated that, I'm sorry, the language, then the description of what we have under references to show that we will be taking that into consideration. Does that fall then under qualifications and experience, that language going there, or does it fall under capability and resources to handle the work?
You know,
I think
not,
it's both.
Sorry, Sue, go ahead. Or Diane, go ahead.
No, I think it would be both. You're going to ask references about all of those things in one and two.
We could simply state in the description for one and two that we will consider input from references in both cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I like the language that you have under references: knowledge, timeliness, communication, firm's overall performance. Those are all great reminders for those of us as we're going through doing the weightings. But I just want to know if we apply that in both one and two or in one section.
That's a great point, Sue. I see what you're saying now. Amy, you may want to take a swing at transitioning that verbiage into the descriptions for one and two.
I definitely will.
It may come out in three also if there's something that they say they're really good at.
or.
Yeah, I'll take a swing at that.
So I am going to ask, has this been shared at the chair, vice chair level, the evaluation yet? Because we've been waiting to do this a long time, and I would hate for us to open RFPs and have a changing evaluation criteria if it's not agreed to by our board.
It has not been shared at that level, Sue. We can do that. The next chair, vice chair meeting isn't until the 23rd of July. But I don't have to wait for the meeting.
I know this throws off the timeline that Amy just talked about with opening them tomorrow, but I do not want these firms to go through this amount of work, the staff to go through this amount of work, and then for us to have a discussion on this at some level with board members and for the agreed to criteria to not be embraced by everyone.
Yeah, why don't you let me run that past? Now, I believe on July 1st, Andrea became the vice chair.
Yep.
According to our election discussion in January. And so, given that she and Graham are both not here, what I will do is reach out to them once we make the changes that we've discussed and let them know that at the committee meeting, it was recommended that we share with them. And we'll do one of two things. Either they can review what we share and comment, or we can schedule a quick meeting with them to discuss.
And just to be clear, let's not open RFPs until that conversation has happened. And I think, you know, in that amount of time, the chair of this committee, Joel, will also be back. And so we'll have a chance to make sure that this is just so important and such a long-term contract. Waiting a couple of weeks, I don't think is going to make a major difference. Even though I know Amy had her letter opener ready to go for tomorrow morning.
I was very excited. Yeah. But I think it's a good idea to wait.
Hey, you know, I have a question, and I think I know the answer, but so have we, when we put out the RFP, did we ask for a primary
yes,
attorney of contact and then their qualifications? And
right, we asked them to make it clear who would be considered the lead for us as a client. So yeah.
Okay.
One thing I might also just add, when I do get to the point where I'm ready to reach out to them and advise each of the respondents, you know, of the timeline, the RFP did state that fees, you know, would need to be good, for lack of a better word, for 60 days. And so in my communication, I'll be asking them to extend that. Hopefully that's not an issue, but I can make you aware if it becomes an issue on any of the respondents.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks all right. Thank you for all of your work on it, Amy. Ted, any CEO and general manager comments?
Two very quick things, Sue. I just want to let you know that demand has moderated quite a bit since the early part of June, mid-June, when we were seeing pumpages in the 80 plus million gallon range, 89 almost one day in mid-June. We're seeing pumpages more in the 50s now, which is very comfortable. The cyanotoxin levels on the raccoon, at least, have been behaving for the most part since that one day that we had some high numbers that I shared with the board. But since then, they've been below detection. We're continuing to monitor it. So we're hoping that with the recent rains, we'll be in a bit more comfortable position from a production perspective here, at least through July, and then we'll see what August brings.
Okay. Anything else for the committee? Okay, I think we need to note that it's 4:20. It didn't even take an hour. And so good job. Thank you, Jen and Amy and Donna and Ted and everyone. If you have any questions, get in touch with Ted. He has all the answers. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you for your confidence.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Bye.
Bye.